welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, we have in studio Barbara Raboy and Ellie Hoffman. Hello, you two beautiful women.
Thank you.
Hi.
Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
So Barbara is a professional musician, and she works for La Clinica de la Raza. Also, she has some very interesting history about the first sperm bank in California. Stay tuned for that. Very exciting story. And Ellie teaches college English, and she's also an instructional designer in higher education. So we are going to get a little bit of education about what the heck that really means. And they've been together 16 years, and they are married. So we're going to talk a lot about not only their professional lives, but their personal lives, how they met, when they came out, when they got married, maybe they have a child together.
Yes, so stay tuned. But first, before we get to their stories, we're going to hear from Greg Moralia, news and events.
I have found Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
Good evening, this is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, November 2nd, 2014. The Human Rights Campaign is urging everyone to get out and vote this Tuesday. The HRC said this November 4th election is critical in determining the state of the U.S. Congress and creating pathways for the passage of fair-minded policies and legislation. Just a few votes can make a big difference this year, and voter turnout is expected to be the lowest in history. In 2012, some races were won by less than 200 votes. The Washington Blade said this midterm election features highly competitive races that will be nail-biters on election night, and among them are key contests of special interest to LGBT people. When the polls close on Tuesday, the results could include the first openly gay person to be elected to the office of governor, the first non-incumbent openly gay Republican to win seats in the U.S. House, and a shift in power in Congress that could affect the flow of pro-LGBT legislation. Republican control of both the House and Senate will likely have an impact on legislation affecting LGBT people, and although the passage of a federal marriage amendment is unlikely, federal legislation enabling discrimination against LGBT people based on religious grounds could emerge. You can learn more about LGBT issues and candidates at hrc.org and eqca.org. If you're a voter here in Sonoma County and have general questions about how to vote, go to vote.sonoma-county.org. And here locally, Sheilyn Stillman and Carsley Gittens made history as Maria Creel High School's homecoming royalty last month. The couple, two girls, became the first same-sex couple in the school's history to win the honor. In a twist on the fall tradition, Maria Creel students placed two sparkling tiaras, rather than a tiara and a crown, on the heads of its junior homecoming princesses. The 16-year-olds have been dating about a year and identify as pansexual, which they say means they consider gender irrelevant to choosing a partner. Having a couple of the same gender on the homecoming court is a first at Maria Creel and appears to be a first in the Santa Rosa City School District. Stillman says, quote, "It feels amazing," after the royalty was named for all four classes, and added, "I'm speechless." Trevor Brady, leadership teacher at Maria Creel, said, "This was a student-driven movement. We had no idea this would happen, or of the level of support that the two would receive. It speaks highly of the student body and their support for equality." He added that there's never been a question between him and school administration and class officers about whether the pair should be able to run, though their nomination did pose some logistical questions. Typically, students nominate couples, with the male half of the couple running for king and the female half running for queen or princess in the case of the junior class. So Brady and the junior class president met with the girls to make sure they were comfortable with the nomination and to figure out the best way to move forward, including what they wanted to be called if they won. The girls, who beat out two boy-girl junior couples in being selected for the homecoming court, decided they both wanted to be called princesses. The pair said they're well known on campus as the only openly gay couple, Most days, they spread out a blanket on the grass and have a picnic together. The girl said that they do feel a part of something bigger than themselves as a national conversation about gay rights plays out at homecoming games across the country. Maria Creo appears to be part of a wave of schools embracing a range of sexual orientations and identities at homecoming games. In states including Texas and Ohio, students this month elected their own openly gay peers to the homecoming court. In Oregon, Ashland High School said they did away with the titles of homecoming king and queen entirely in favor of gender-neutral terms, Grizzly Royalty, after the school's mascot. And finally, Face to Face invites you to a performance of the acclaimed San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus Holiday Celebration, a festive and heartwarming and simply not-to-be-missed extravaganza. The evening features the traditional favorites along with some new works, including a stunning world premiere by Olga Guillelo, one of America's most prominent contemporary composers. Other appearances include Santa with his elves and reindeer, a 1980s nativity scene, and an ugly sweater parade. In the spirit of the season, a portion of the proceeds from the concert will benefit Face to Face and its mission to end HIV in Sonoma County while supporting those living with HIV/AIDS. The event is being held at the Wells Fargo Center for the Arts on December 6th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $25 to $50, and they're on sale now. You can learn more at wellsfargocenterarts.org. For more information about LGBT events happening here in the North Bay, go to gaysonoma.com. And if you have news or an event you'd like to share with our listeners, tell us about it by going to our own website at outbeatnews.com. Follow us all week long on Facebook and Twitter for the latest LGBT news and information from here in the North Bay and beyond. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Now back to Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Greyer.
Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana Sheridan, and I'm Sheridan. And we're in studio this evening with Barbara Raboy and Ellie Hoffman. Welcome back, everyone.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get this conversation started. I remember back in June, what a refresher. Thank you, guys. June at Pride, we met. And so we just want to kind of get the audience caught up. So we came up to you, like we went up to like many, many folks, and you two volunteered to be on our show, and we love that. And here you are. We finally was able to pin down a date. And so we just want to say hello and thank you and welcome. And so why did you want to come on the show?
Well, it was really nice that day in Guerneville, seeing your smiling faces and holding out that microphone to us.
This is Ellie talking.
Yeah. I think we said a few words about Pride that day. And I don't know, I just thought maybe you figured we could complete our sentences, and so you invited us to come back and be on this show, which we both immediately said yes.
I just do whatever she tells me to do.
Oh, we've heard that before. That was Barbara, by the way. So let's get, before we get into deeper stuff and how you met and all of that stuff, but we're just curious about your jobs and, you know, the instructional design type. You know, because that was the first time I heard of it. So would you share that with the audience? Ellie.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So it's an exciting field. So just stop me whenever you want. Instructional design is about analysis of learning needs. And it's about developing training. And that's mostly in the private sector. I'm an instructional designer in higher ed. And so our connection is very much to pedagogy, and it often, but not always, involves technology, educational technology. Really, it's about the science of how people learn and adult learning and how to create great learning environments and coaching faculty into effective ways of teaching their learners. And it addresses teachers as learners. So that's the section of it that really excites me. And I've done it in different areas, from community college to the UC system. I'm on my way back to a private university right now to help with a new online MSN program there. So it really, it's everywhere and more places than you realize that it's being used.
So what's the excitement? I mean, I feel that coming. I want the audience to hear that, see that.
So I came into instructional design from teaching. So I'm also a college English teacher, and I love teaching, and I love learning. I'm a lifelong learner, and I was kind of a late bloomer in my own adult education. And so I just keep going with both, and I love where they intersect. And to me, they all, teaching and learning, are a complete intersection.
Mm. Cool.
When I hear you talk about instructional design and technology, I used to teach high school, middle school and high school. And when cell phones started surfacing, all the staff would say, put your cell phone away, put your cell phone away. Because the kids, they would get calls in the middle of class, you know, hi, mom, how you doing? It's like, what the heck? And then I started hearing other teachers, not from my school, but other teachers saying, God, we need to give lessons on our cell phones. All the kids have them. Mm. They all have access to the internet. So why aren't we embracing this technology? So can you address that real quick before we move on to Barbara and what she does?
Sure. You always want to meet your learners where they are. And that's a great example of that. So I invite my college students to use their cell phones for learning. So for example, if I'm writing something on the board and I go, oh, class, do I have this spelled right? Because people love to see English teachers misspell words. And I'll say, well, look it up on your phones. Am I spelling it right? Don't guess. Look it up on your phones. So it's about getting them just to use their technology in all kinds of ways. And I have them look stuff up, and I have them find materials and share information. And I do surveys online with them, even in the classroom, all the time.
Wow. And what it's a fun. Shift. Whole total different shift.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, well, I don't tell them to put their phones away.
Yeah, so then somebody might say to you, so what are you going to do with a kid who, or a student who, you know, you tell everyone to look it up, but really that student is texting someone or reading Facebook? Or so how would you respond to that? Because I think that's what teachers are afraid of, just not the focus of the students.
Yeah, teachers are afraid of that. I think the goal is always to make the class engaging enough, and of course this is pie in the sky, but to make the class engaging enough. And I do very student-centered learning, so my students are always active, so it's a little harder for them to be distracted by their phones and, you know, being on Facebook. I'm not saying that they don't do it, but they're always doing group work, they're always speaking. I do very little lecturing. I have them up there doing presentations all the time. So it makes it a little hard for them. And if their phone rings in class, I usually dance or sing, and I can't carry a tune. So it's pretty funny when I do that. And they don't want to hear me sing anymore, so they stop that.
I love it.
I love it.
I love your
Thank
attitude,
you.
Ellie.
Thank you, Ellie. Every teacher should listen to the first 5 minutes of this interview, at least.
Oh, my
yeah.
word.
Of course, so, I think she has a great voice, but, you know, that's because I'm still in love with her.
After 16 years, you better be, honey. Oh. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Barbara. Do you go by Barb or Barbara?
Barb is great.
Barb. Mm-hmm. Okay. So tell us a little bit about yourself and the whole Clinique de la Raza.
Yeah. So I work for a really outstanding nonprofit organization that's headquartered in Oakland. It's called La Clinica de la Raza. It's a nonprofit organization. It's over 40 years old, and its roots started in the early 1970s by a group of Latino and Latina students at UC Berkeley who wanted to bring free healthcare services in a community model to the Fruitvale District of Oakland. And so I'm a regional manager, and I oversee a group of medical clinics, lab, and optometry, and we have school-based health centers and many public schools in Oakland that we run. And this job keeps me very busy. I've been in the healthcare field for about really since the mid-70s, and this is a great job for me to have. I've I feel that I have a lot of influence over, you know, making, having us basically provide high quality services, and I have access to the executives in the agency, and I get and give a lot of respect, and that means a lot to me. And I've mostly only worked in nonprofit healthcare organizations my adult life, so feels good philosophically as well.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about the little hint I gave at the beginning of the show.
So is it, by any chance, the sperm bank hint?
That's it.
So, because I was working at the Feminist Women's Health Center back in, you know, the mid to late 70s, et cetera, that particular clinic, I was teaching fertility awareness classes, and there were a number of lesbian women in particular who were coming to these classes who were asking me to teach them sort of when is the best time to try to get pregnant, even though traditionally fertility awareness is a contraceptive method, so you try to avoid pregnancy. So began the journey where I put together a couple of proposals, talked to the executive director at the time, and recommended that we start a donor insemination program and potentially buy some sperm samples from another sperm bank somewhere in California or outside of the state. So I visited a sperm bank in Southern California, and I was kind of blown away at how simple the operation was. And I came back, I started writing some notes on the airplane. Little did I know that was sort of become part of our technical manual. But I went back to my boss and I said, well, we can start that donor insem or DI program, or we can go one step further and, you know, do a sperm bank where we had more control over the screening of the donors and set our own policies and practices around what's proper testing and that sort of thing. So my boss, being very sort of entrepreneurial herself, said, oh, I think we should do the sperm bank. And it was like, well, who's going to do this? None of us knew anything really about sperm banking. But, you know, then began the learning journey. So I did a lot of research. I met with some lab techs at Alta Bates Hospital at the time. I went and visited a few of the sperm banks. And October 5th, I think it was 1982, we launched the Sperm Bank of Northern California. And then eventually the health center folded. That was in 1988. And then I took the sperm bank program out of the health center and formed a nonprofit corporation. And then eventually we've moved the sperm bank to Berkeley. And I stayed with the organization. I was the executive director till about 1995. And then I decided it was just time to branch out. I felt like I had done everything I could possibly do to really launch the organization and build it and develop the kinds of progressive practices and policies that I and my peers and members of the board thought were really important for society. I think one example of that is the donor identity release option, which is still very, very in high demand, and there are a few of the sperm banks around the country that now offer that, so that the donor gives, signs a contract basically saying, I'm willing to be identified by an offspring as long as the sperm bank can link that child to my sample. As long as that child turns 18, I'll be okay with that. So I think, from what I understand from talking to some of the staff there, that there are a number of grown children who have requested the name of the donor. Hmm. So very interesting.
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, pat on your back.
Wow.
Virtual pat on your back. I mean, that's really forward thinking when you come up with an idea that's not been done before.
Yeah, it had never been done in this country, and it was one of the most difficult experiences I had in developing the sperm bank over those years, was that everybody in the industry, so to speak, it was kind of a cottage industry. It was not regulated at the time. Individual, either business people or scientists, were running their own sperm banks, and no one thought that they should have a sort of a common approach or a set of protocols that everyone would follow, like the blood banking industry. And I was treated pretty disrespectfully by a lot of people in the scientific community who own their sperm banks, because I was not a scientist. You know, I have a degree in anthropology, and I was a health educator and an abortion counselor, and then I started a sperm bank. And So anyhow, I think what really helped me and the health center and the sperm bank really stand apart was our strong beliefs and how important it is for a woman or a couple to really have informed consent and being able to choose the donor and feel good about their decision and talk about it and be honest with their children. And I think the whole ID release thing came from that place. Because if a woman wants to get pregnant and is purposefully choosing a donor to be identified, that helps promote an honest conversation at different times in that child's life as the child is growing up. Mm. Because up until then, everything was so secretive. The whole infertility industry and the few sperm banks that were in practice at the time, everyone always was advising, you never want to tell your child how your child was conceived. At that time, the paradigm started shifting, and it's in general today our society is more open to the donor identity release option and having those open conversations with children about how they came into the world. And adoption also has become more progressive.
Mm-hmm. I'm just sitting here wondering if that's the paradigm of those days, and here you come changing or advocating for an identification system. I mean, why?
Well, I think,
where did you come from?
You know, I just remember when I started working at the Feminist Women's Health Center and I was trained to be an abortion counselor. I have to say I'm very pro-choice. I'm pro-abortion. I feel strongly about Roe versus Wade. But the thing that really caught me was that every woman that was coming in for a possible abortion, we treated with such dignity and respect and made sure that woman knew exactly what was going to happen to her body and she fully understood how to take care of herself after. And there was something about treating women respectfully and making sure they had all their questions answered and they knew that we were there to listen, hold their hand, and be there for them. And in thinking about the sperm bank, when I did my early research and I saw how secretive the industry was, part of it was, I think, fear. I think at the time, first of all, the industry was very disorganized. They weren't unified. They hadn't come under the microscope. We didn't have HIV or HIV antibody testing yet. So there was a lot of, everyone was kind of doing their own thing, and there probably were some providers who were giving their own sperm samples to some couples, and the record keeping was weak. Right. And it wasn't just ID release, but it was, we made a commitment that we would limit the number of children from each donor to 10. And no other sperm bank in the country had done that. They didn't even feel it was necessary to set a limit. And a lot of it is because for them it was a commercial operation. And we were operating as a nonprofit, so we really saw it more as a service. And as a woman, thinking about giving a semen sample to another woman and thinking, wow, this is like could be the future, the half of your future child. How could we not want to look at the social context of that transaction? It wasn't just a commercial transaction. There's people that are going to be born as a result of this. And we felt we have a specific responsibility to make sure we've done really good genetic history taking, that we maintain contact with the donor. So if there's something that happens later on, hopefully we know about it. Those are just many of the things that people running these sperm banks were thinking, you're going to put us out of business, Barb. Who has the money and the time to do all that record keeping? Mm-hmm. Who has the money and the time to explain to a donor that it might be of benefit to society for you to be an ID release donor? And it was a profit model. And I think we kind of said, well, that's not our model. Mm-hmm. It's really about just being human and offering a service that's humanitarian.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm. Thank you for your heart. Thank you both for your heart. I think we need to take a break and come back and learn about the relationship.
Sounds good. We have a wonderful song. It's a new pop artist, Sia singing Chandelier.
Party girls, don't get hurt, can't feel anything. When will I learn? I push it down, push it down. I'm the one for a good time call, phone's blowing up. Ring on my doorbell, I feel the love, feel the love. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, drink. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, drink. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, drink. Turn back the light knows.
With Sia with her new song Chandelier. You can check her out on YouTube. She's very interesting to look at. She dances the whole time and never seen her before, but I've heard the song before. So thank you, Greg. He brought that into the studio to share with us. We're back with Ellie and Barb, and we are at the point where we'd like to learn about them as a couple. A couple, a married couple, mothers. So why don't we start with how y'all met? So Ellie, could you start and just let us know your story?
Sure. So Barb and I did not meet when we were young. We were in our late 40s, early 50s. And for me, it was the first and only blind date of my life. I was totally resistant. Kind of ignored my friend who told me there was someone she wanted me to meet. And finally, just to pacify Lori, our wonderful friend Lori, who was a mutual friend, said, okay, I'll meet her. And so Barb called me and we went for a walk.
Yeah, we met at a bookstore, outdoor bookstore, well, kind of a patio area of an outdoor bookstore in Emeryville, and just walked and walked and talked and talked. And I think for both of us, for whatever reason, we both realized that we have some similar backgrounds, and similar family dynamics and come from a similar cultural background. And then, you know, it was time to go. My son was at home, and at that time I was living in Pacifica. And then we had more dates. We had a few more dates, and then the rest is history.
Right. I was in grad school at the time. I was working full-time and teaching on the side, and I was going to grad school. And
that's a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot. Still kind of like that. And at the end of that wonderful long walk, Barb asked if she could see me again. And I said, yes, but I'm in the middle of writing a paper, so maybe in 2 or 3 weeks?
Uh-oh.
Well, fortunately, she didn't follow my...
What did she do?
She called and left a message, I think, the next day.
Oh, you naughty girl.
And it was not only a message. She was reciting Italian, not in Italian, but Italian love poetry on my message.
After one walk?
Yes.
Woman.
I remember the poet's name, Giuseppe.
Do you remember the poem? Can you say
it? I don't. I have it at home. Oh. I don't have it memorized.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So our courtship, Barb was living in Pacifica and I was living in Oakland, and Ray was 16 at the time. So
who's Ray?
Ray is our son, who was at the time Barb's son, and so he was still in high school. And so our courtship consisted of, on the weekends, I cook, and Barb likes to eat my cooking. So I would work on a paper. This was a master's in English, so I was writing a lot of papers about literature. So on Saturdays, I would write and write and write and write, and then I would stop in the late afternoon, and Barb would come over, and I'd start cooking, and then we'd eat dinner and watch either movies of Shakespeare plays or old movies of Dickens books, and she was right there. And to me, that, I mean, those were some really strong, early, good signs that she just embraced what I was doing. Yeah, and supported me so fully. And she has done so ever since, because a decade later, I went back to school for another degree. And she saw me through that one, too.
Another master's? Or
yeah.
Uh-huh. In instructional design.
Education,
oh,
yeah.
In education.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Wow.
Oh, that's wonderful. Sounds beautiful. So you were able to get those papers done, plus more.
And cool. I think early on in our relationship, when we were falling deeply in love with each other, we had started talking about wanting to live together. And even something as important but basic as, but I'm not sure that I want to live with you yet. I want to make sure my son does okay in college for the first year. So we really sort of paced moving in instead of doing the real fast, you know, get the U-Haul in 3 weeks and move in. I think the thing that we were both more mature, and I think because I had a very strong relationship with my son as a single parent raising him, I did want to make sure after graduation he started college and he was away at school. So I, you know, you hear a lot of things about sometimes young people that are away at school for the first year have difficulty adjusting. I just wanted to make sure I was there to give him as full attention as I could. And he was doing fine, and then we realized, okay, we can move in. Let's do it. So we just waited that first year after he started school. So it was about 2 years or so after we met, I think, that we started living together. And I moved in with Ellie because she owned the home that we moved into, and that just made more sense than renting in Pacifica.
So what adjustments did you have to make, Ellie, having a son? I'm just curious about that.
Well,
were you expecting to have kids?
Like, great question. Yeah. So, no. I mean, I had thought about parenting when I was younger and had not had a burning urge to procreate and didn't and decided not to. But when I met Barb and It was a package deal. There was a dog, there was a kid, there was the girl. And fortunately, I fell in love with all of them. And what I realized very early on was that Ray, our son, and Barb were very, very close. And I knew intuitively and intellectually that I should not attempt to push too hard into that connection. And I also realized that I should not try hard to suddenly be another parent to Ray. And so I did follow his lead, and I just kind of went at his pace as far as Ray and I growing closer together. And he was away at college for 5 years. He ended up on the 5-year plan. It all worked out fine. He ended up with 2 degrees, so it was all good. But so it was slow and over the years, we have become very, very close, and we are a family now, and he has a fiance, and they're living in London right now. And in fact, I knew Jody, his fiance, before he did, because she's also an instructional designer, and we met at San Francisco State. But no, I did not set them up. Everyone always asks, but no, I did not mean to set them up. It just happened. So we're a close family now, and it all worked out. And eventually, you know, Ray did come to embrace me as his other parent. But as he says, I didn't help raise him, but I helped him become an adult. Mm-hmm. And I'm really happy with that.
Mm-hmm. What does he call you?
Ellie.
Mm. Nice. So tell us a little bit about your family and your support system when you got together, because we want to hear about the wedding and the marriage or whatever. Yeah. Whatever you want to call it.
Well, I just, you know, as Ellie mentioned, by time we met, we were a bit older. We each had our share of other relationships and had learned and grown from those relationships. And when I think about started living together, you know, I think it took me probably a good 5 years of feeling like this person that I'm with, I can so trust with anything that I do in the world. And I think we started thinking about getting married when we started hearing about what was going on in San Francisco at the time. Mayor Gavin Newsom was saying, well, let's just start the civil ceremonies and events. And I think that was in 2008.
No.
Do I have, or is it? No, I'm off. 2004?
Four.
Yeah. And we were out of the country at the time. We were visiting my sister in New Zealand, and her brother-in-law walked in the room and he said, Gavin Newsom is marrying in San Francisco. And we were like, what? Huh? we didn't know it was coming. And so, you know, that history kind of came and went. And then in 2008, when we were able to be married, I proposed to Barb over cell phone. Yes, that was before the laws were different. And it was a very political decision. I've never been interested in marriage, and I am very familiar with the history of marriage, and it's not something I ever had any interest in. And so it was a very political decision. Having said that, we ended up having 3 wedding celebrations.
Three?
Well, so let's go back before we talk about the wedding celebrations, and please define what you mean by political. It was a political decision.
Right. So marriage is a very patriarchal institution, and the history is about ownership of property and women. And from an early age, Before I had any clue that I was a lesbian, I knew that I was not interested in marriage. I had plenty of boyfriends, but I just felt like it was some kind of a restriction that I didn't want to have on me. And so I was fine not being married. And even after Barb and I got married, or while we're getting married, I remember someone saying, "Wasn't it just more special now because you're married?" And I have to say the answer is no. It was already very special, and I was already very committed and very in love, and we already were a very strong family without the marriage. Why political? For equality, for fairness, mm-hmm. for equal privilege. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Barb, you feel the same way, or what?
Yeah, I do, because growing up also, I was a very, very independent young person growing up, and I never liked the idea of feeling sort of held down, and I always associated marriage with holding someone down. And also, my parents didn't have a really healthy relationship when they were married, and that was my model. That's who I had in my life, and I was very skeptical about, you know, this thing of marriage. And I think also deciding to have a child independent of marriage, I continued having strong feelings even up until when I met Ellie about how, you know, marriage is, it's a piece of paper. But it really wasn't until I started thinking about the implications for gays and lesbians in terms of equality, the ability to perhaps adopt a lot easier when you're married than when you're not, and how beyond domestic partnerships marriage could go. I think those were some of the things in my mind that made me feel like this was a political decision. Because we did do the domestic partnership. We filled out, did our paper and filed it and had it notarized, sent it to the state. I think it's because we saw that there were some protections there as well.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about family. I mean, you had a wedding or some ceremony, and you have family show up, so your support system's there for you?
Yeah, we had a lot of support. So we went to the Oakland courthouse to get married. And that June, right, when we entered that six-month period before Prop 8 passed, where we could get married. It was June, and we were at a family gathering. And my Aunt Gloria, and we kind of said, yeah, and we're getting married. And my Aunt Gloria, who's in her 80s, immediately said, "Oh, well, I'll give you a reception in Southern California," because I'm from Southern California, "so that everyone can come without, you know, having to travel to Northern California." And she did that. Ooh. And my parents were already deceased, but all of my Southern California relatives and cousins did come. And then, so that was two, because after the courthouse we celebrated too. And then we also had our own homemade celebration in a friend's yard, a beautiful yard in Oakland. And both of my sisters were there, one from New Zealand and one from Southern California, and Barb's brother came from New York, and mm-hmm. our son was still living in the States, and he was there, and so many friends and family, mm-hmm. although Barb's dad did not come.
Yeah, that was really upsetting and disappointing for me, because my dad was always touting how open-minded and liberal he is, and I think ultimately he was. He passed away a little over a year ago, but there was something about his relationship with his partner at the time, Francis, and I think just not thinking it was all that important, just not having it be something at the top of their list, mm-hmm. so they made some excuse why they couldn't make it. Mm. And it, but that also was consistent with what it was like growing up in my family. I sort of felt like I was in the shadows a lot. And if I hadn't done something myself to make something happen, it wouldn't have happened. Mm. But it was disappointing. But having our son there and my brother and a couple of really close friends from New York came in, another good friend I grew up with that lives here in Oakland, that also meant a lot to me. Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it was a little bit bittersweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's unfortunate that happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think as far as the institution of marriage, and gay marriage, I have changed in my own teaching, for example, to my students, because I used to not come out to my students because I teach critical thinking, and I didn't want to influence them. I wanted them to say what was on their mind and not feel like they, you know, not tiptoe around because if they knew I was a lesbian. And fast forward to 2014, I tell my students I'm a married lesbian because I teach social constructs, and I always tell them the thing about social constructs is that they change. So what better example is there than to talk about same-sex marriage and how it has changed in the last few years? I mean, I'm actually amazed that this has all happened in my lifetime. I didn't expect it. So while I am not, you know, personally the institution of marriage itself isn't important to me, but the rights and privilege that come with it and how quickly things have been changing is just phenomenally exciting to me that we have these changes.
Mm-hmm. I want to applaud your visibility. We need more people to, more teachers to model that. So, yeah. So, time's ticking. So, I want to know about this laughter thing in your relationship. I want to know how you have fun in your relationship.
Well,
yeah, give us some snippets of some stories or something about the fun times in your relationship. Oh, they staring at each other, everybody.
I don't know. They're smiling at each other, too.
I mean, smiling and staring.
Yeah. I will make a general comment, okay. But you're probably better at remembering the examples. It's just that even when we have an argument and we're yelling, it's kind of like voices are really out there. Like 5 or 10 minutes later, it's like we realize the thing we were arguing about was so little and that we start laughing. We can't stop laughing. It's like from one extreme to the other. Because the bottom line is that our core values, we're very in sync with each other. We both have fundamentally working class values. We both are Jewish, although not religious. We identify as Jews culturally. And our politics, you know, we're very left. And so that's, and we're both learners. We feel it's important to always learn, however one learns. Mm. So we have all of that in common. But it's the laughter. And I don't know why. It's the little things. It's like, I didn't like the way you, like, we had this guy who's doing some work in our house. I just thought of an example. Our Guerneville house. And he laid some of the boards, the wood, on a grassy area near a tree we planted. And I got pretty pissed. I was pretty upset about how this is looking messy now and this is going to take months. And she's telling me to take a chill pill and I'm like getting more agitated. It's just a couple of boards of wood. And then really, it was like, she's absolutely right. And then it was good to kind of laugh. I came back and apologized for being kind of nasty to her. And then, you know, we laughed because it's like something is a couple of pieces of wood on the grass. I mean, what's the big deal? Mm-hmm. So I don't know what else to say, but, it's the ability to come back together and say, if we're going to have an argument, let's make it over something really important next time, okay?
And we have a rule that we try to follow. I think we're pretty good at following it, which is, if we do argue, we try not to go to bed mad.
Wow. And that's been successful, huh?
Mostly. Mm-hmm. Mostly. There have been a few turnbacks.
Turn back.
Back to back.
Turn back. 16 years together. Yeah. Wow. That's wonderful. What else you can share around? How do you make it work? Because that's the question that we get all the time. How do you make it work?
I think, oops, you're going to go?
You go ahead. And
I think one thing that we both feel strongly about and recognize and acknowledge frequently to each other and thank each other for is that we allow each other to kind of blossom in our own ways. And we are both very independent people. So Barb works all day and then she goes and plays music most evenings. I work all day and then I get onto my online class or I go teach a face-to-face class at night. So in other words, we're both really busy. And as I said earlier, you know, she saw me through 2 master's degrees and I've seen relationships just crumble under that kind of stress. So we are both secure enough in ourselves and trustful of each other that we encourage each other to follow our hearts. So Barb was always a musician, and she stopped for 18 years while she was raising a son. And then she went back to her music. And I'm thrilled. Mm. At that. Mm-hmm. And it's her passion and she's good and she just grows, you know, every 3 months it's a new instrument and maybe every 6 months. And I'm happy for her. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy for her. So we give each other a lot of space in that way. We're not merged in the minute to minute, but we are merged in our values. And I think that is a big key to our success.
No, you've said it. I can't think of anything to add. I think sometimes I will say I see couples who they go food shopping together, they pay the bills together, they make all everything they have to do together. And we do certain things together, but there's a lot of things we don't do together. We have our own circles of friends and interests, and the trust is there, as Ellie mentioned, and the space is there. And that feels like really healthy to, you know, at this point in our lives.
Barb, did you shower Ellie at times with your beautiful music?
Well, she will come to an occasional performance, yeah. And I think that's how I shower her. You know, I like to, when I perform, I like to be with an ensemble, part of a group experience. And so she's heard some of the plays I've done. And I'm in the Berklee Jazz Conservatory big band. Mm. So she's heard a few of those performances, yeah.
Wow.
So what do you play?
Oh, right. So I play B-flat and bass clarinet, alto sax, tenor sax, soprano sax, and I'm studying flute.
Wow. Well, flute and sax, you know, most jazz musicians play both because the fingerings are so similar, right?
Yes, they are.
Yeah. I remember growing up playing flute and say, I'll never play sax because I'm not ruining my embouchure. I had my nose way up in the sky, too high.
Well, I do notice, though, that if I start my morning routine of, let's say this morning I started practicing 2 saxophones, I can't play the flute right after. I have to wait several hours because the flute embouchure is so different and so sensitive.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And well, Sheridan, Barb did say for years when she was playing just B-flat clarinet that she would not play saxophone. I'll just say that.
And here we are laughing about it.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, it's been so wonderful having you both on our show tonight. We have about another minute. So is there anything else that you would like to leave the world with? Is there anything that you would like someone to know when they listen to the show, either now or in the future when we're archiving our show on outbeatradio.org?
Wow.
Anything?
Some encouragement or advice, whatever label you want to use.
But getting together in your older years. I mean, I heard something about being mature.
Yeah, I think the thought, sometimes Ellie and I have said this early on when we first met, it's like, why couldn't we have met sooner? I wouldn't have had to have gone through those three or four relationships. I wouldn't have had to have that other pain or that hurt. So I think what we realize is, but we might not have been together then. And it's good that we're together now. So we bring all our experiences and developed selves into this more mature relationship. So it's not that it shouldn't have happened, but this is when it's going to happen.
Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We want to remind everyone that like Ellie and Barb, you too can be living proof that through sharing your story, you can help our community become more visible and be seen and embraced as vibrant, proud, and courageous. We thank you both so much for coming.
Thank you.
This is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back next month on another wonderful interview on Living Proof. Until then,
good night.
It's never too late to try. What have you done today to make you feel proud? You could be so many people if you make that grab for freedom.
Tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Music with Michaela Cannon. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. Support for Outbeat Radio and KRCBFM comes from members and from General Organics, sustainably produced plant foods and supplements for modern cultivation. General Organics fertilizers are veganic, vegan and organic, produced from botanical extracts and natural minerals for plant nutrition at the molecular level. You'll find them on the web at genhydro.com. Have you downloaded the new KRCB app yet? Well, now you can take KRCB Radio and listen to great programs like Outbeat Radio from anywhere in the world. The app is free, and you can download it right now at the Apple Store or Google Play. You're listening to KRCB FM Windsor Santa Rosa, the new 91 with news, new music, and more. This is KRCB. It's just before 9 p.m. Stay with us. Climate One is next.
It's never too late to try. What have you done? Change, yeah. So do it today, yeah. 'Cause I can see you there.